Anyway, I'm following on from the talk that was happened 2 weeks ago. It was on singleness and dating. Wendy Mann and Phil Wolfe did an outstanding job. If you haven't listened to it at all, please do. It is really good. And we're talking about marriage tonight. Now, some of you are married, and this will apply directly to you. Others of you are dating, and it will apply eventually. Others of you have seen marriages that haven't worked, and I want to give you a picture of marriage working. I want to give you some hope tonight. Some of you, or some of us, are leading or will lead married, and I want to give you some insight into that. But there'll also be principles that we share tonight that will apply to friendships and relationships in general. I was challenged this morning in worship just to start by honouring God. At the age of 18, I declared that I was never going to get married. It came from a place of hurt. I was emotionally damaged through my teenage years with a series of rejections by people. And I was determined not to let someone get that close again. And then I met PJ, and things changed a bit. But I was still quite closed off emotionally. I told the story this morning of us walking along a single track together, and I was in front, and Paul told me for the first time that he loved me, and I didn't say anything. I had no way of knowing what to do with that, and I carried on walking. And I remember it as getting to the end of the walk, and Paul saying, did you hear me? And I was like, yeah. And that was it. Could give nothing. I was that damaged. And I just want to honour God, really. Just he can make the impossible possible. And he can take someone who was emotionally shut down and damaged and had a big fear of rejection and bring healing and freedom so that I can be standing up here tonight and talking about marriage. And Paul and I have been married for 15 years, and I can say I love him more tonight than I did when I married him 15 years ago. It's good. Anyway, so we're talking about marriage and how our church culture of honour, generosity, authenticity, acceptance and courage work out in it. I know from experience that marriage is a good thing, but also at times hard work. It can give you incredible high on the days where you emotionally and physically connect with your spouse, but it can be horrendous to live in when you do and say things that are hurtful, damaging and destructive and you don't know a way forward. You have feelings of intense love, feelings of real hate, times of living and having fun with your best friend, and times of dealing with someone who feels like a total stranger and yet you're sharing a house with them. Paul and I would like to share some things this evening that have helped us in our marriage. Some things I've just said have just been by God revealing them by his grace, and we've changed and grown together as we've known more of who God is and his love for us. Other times we've read books, we've listened to preach series, we've attended courses. We're hungry to learn anything that will help us or have material that gets us talking at a deeper level. We've also had help. We've prayed through hurts that have damaged our relationship. And for the first few years of our marriage, we used to go and visit Dave and Philippa Stroud in Birmingham. David used to be the pastor who started the King's Arms. And we would come to them with a list of things that we needed advice on or just help in seeing a way forward on. And basically tonight, I want to encourage us not to settle in our marriages. I'm passionate about marriage. It's a good word to use in this context, isn't it? We have such a high calling. I want my marriage and our marriages to be the best they can be. The way we're going to approach it is that Paul is going to come and speak now predominantly to the men, and then I'm going to speak mainly to the women here. And whilst we're aiming this at marriage, like I said, some of the principles will apply to friendships and relationships generally, whether we're married or not.
Brilliant. Well, good stuff. Good evening, guys. Nice to see you. I'm going to dive straight in just for the sake of time, if that's okay. So, chaps, this is for you this evening, whether you're married or not, because I believe there's relevance right across the board. The first way that I want us to be looking at reflecting our culture in marriage is that we're to demonstrate courage as guys, that as men we're to demonstrate courage, and courage is one of our values within our culture. 1 Corinthians 11 verse 3 says this, "But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God." Husbands, like it or not, You have been placed in a position of leadership. That's what headship means. You are the head. God has put you in a place of dignity and of leadership. As husbands, God has given us a role to play. All we need to do now is to live out who he has made us to be in the first place. We have authority. But what I want you to notice just from this short verse up here is that this verse doesn't say that you are the ultimate authority. No, it says the head of every man is Christ. In other words, God is the supreme authority. Think of it this way. God has entrusted one of his daughters, if you're married, to your care. Think about that for a moment. You're married to one of his precious girls. So we need to treat these girls right, partly because we're men of dignity, but equally too because they are princesses of the king. So this is not carte blanche for some guy to just act like a tin pot dictator in his own home. Instead, Paul writes that there's a mandate on us as husbands to love our wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. It's a sacrificial, laying down your life kind of love. So what does this mean in practice? How should this look in an average week? Well, firstly, I want to pull out the fact that headship means for us to be protecting our wives. Hopefully you don't live in a position of constant mortal peril, but do remember that Jesus died for the church, and if push comes to shove, well, that's in your role, in your job description too. But it might have little outworkings in practical little ways. So for instance, in our marriage, I always sleep on the side of the bed that is nearest to the bedroom door. That way, if anyone ever should burst through our bedroom door in the middle of the night, then can put my body between them and Emma. It's a small little thing, I know. Now, to be honest, after 15 years of marriage, I've not yet had to tackle a burglar. But we do have 4 small children, and regularly I've had to handle them as they've burst in through the door and say, "Daddy, I've wet the bed," or "Daddy, I feel a bit..." and then throw up on me. Various things like that have happened. So I am the first line of defense between them and Emma. But more often than that, I think protecting your wife means being prepared to deal with confrontation when it arises. I remember when we first got married, we bought a small terraced house in Bedford. And during the buying process, I distinctly remember asking the previous owners, "What are the neighbors like?" And they said, "Oh, you'll have no problems there. There's a sweet old little lady who lives next door." They lied to me. In fact, there was a whole community of travellers who lived next door. At one time, 14 of them lived in that tiny little house. Now, I'm sure most travellers are lovely, reasonable people, but I had a character building 18 months living next door to these guys. There were so many of them living in the house that in the summertime, some of them would sleep in the back garden naked. I've received prayer for that issue. At one point, they decided that they would form a street circus with jugglers, musicians, I use the term loosely, and fire breathers. So much so that one morning I remember walking out my front door as a sheet of flame passed across in front of my face. I kid you not. I remember very clearly the first time that we had problems. We were woken at 2 a.m. in the morning, and it was the sound of someone out in the street chopping wood with an axe. And I realized that our neighbors, God bless them, were starting a party and lighting a fire to help with that. Emma looked across at me in the bed and said to me, "Honey, we can't sleep. I think one of us is going to need to go and speak to the neighbours." Now, I hadn't been married long at that point, but somehow, instinctively, I knew that that meant me. So I said to her, "Don't worry, darling. I'll go and have a chat with the 14 drunken, fire-breathing, axe-wielding neighbours next door. Just as a point of reference, I would like lilies on my coffin, should it ever become relevant." Guys, it matters not whether it's a utility company that's overcharged you, or waiters who served your wife cold food, or repairmen who don't turn up, or drunken hippies that live next door. The primary role of confrontation and protection, I believe, rests with a man. And I know that you feel sick to your stomach at the thought of having to complain to someone. And I know it takes every ounce of courage that you possess to confront someone. But that doesn't stop it being your job. Also, as an aside, I want to say to all of us guys that we have a general responsibility to act as godly men to the godly women in this church. Sometimes we're going to need to act courageously for a single mum who has no husband to fight her corner for her. And sometimes you'll need to help a single lady in the church who's been taken for a ride by the mechanic in the garage or whatever it might be. I realise that you hate doing that stuff. It feels uncomfortable. We're British. We don't like confrontation. Unless, of course, it's with the French. But generally speaking, we seem to have an exception there. But generally speaking, we don't like confrontation. I still feel nervous and sick every time I have to protect my family and my wife and to have to confront somebody. But, you know, at the end of the day, I'm not going to allow my feelings to dictate the way that I live my life. I want to live out of my convictions rather than my fears. And guys, I'm urging you to do the same. So that's the first thing. We've got a responsibility to protect. But the second area where we need to have some courage is to spiritually lead. Now, by this, I don't mean to go suddenly super religious on your wife, but rather instead to be an example of someone who is pursuing God for all that they're worth. And then for your wife to respond in kind to that. Maybe read the Bible and share with her what stood out to you. Or perhaps read a psalm to her last thing at night before you go to sleep. If you run after God, it will make life so much easier for her. Be the first one to initiate prayer in the family. When I pray with Emma, I'm not trying to hold a prayer meeting. You know, I don't have an agenda and I very rarely have a PowerPoint. And more, I'm just trying to pray with my best friends. That's what prayer life means in a marriage. And find out what works for you. Find out what fits with your lifestyle. We find it best to pray on car journeys. That way there aren't so many distractions around us. And I get Mondays off. So now on a Monday morning, Emma and I will drive to Milton Keynes and back again, literally just so we can get the time together and pray. We generally go to the IKEA in Milton Keynes. And being a smooth operator, I treat Emma to a 99 pence breakfast there. Oh, yeah. I know how to show a girl a good time. And I guess in one way, it makes no sense at all. We spend £10 on petrol getting to Milton Keynes, and then I buy her a 99 pence breakfast. But it's really about getting the time together. It's one of those situations where the journey really is more important than the destination. I guess I'd ask you, what will work for you? How are you spiritually leading your wife at the moment? What are you doing to help her connect with Jesus? Is she growing spiritually under your leadership, or is she somewhat struggling? If she is, then do something to change that situation. So that's the second thing. The third area where we need to have courage is that to take responsibility. I guess ever since the Garden of Eden, we've needed to fight the temptation to abdicate the responsibility that God has given us as men. So make sure that you take responsibility for the important conversations, you know, planning your future or what family life should look like or booking in date nights or stuff to do with the children and parents' evenings, whatever it might look like. Now, obviously, as guys, that doesn't mean to say that you have to do everything. This is a partnership. But what it does mean is that you are responsible for seeing that everything gets done and there's a difference. So, for instance, in our marriage, we had to decide which one of us would be responsible for keeping the household accounts, the bookkeeping side of things. And we had two options, Emma or me. And now Emma has over 12 years' experience as a finance officer. She's experienced in pensions, salaries, and payroll software. Whereas I, 20 years ago, did a very short course in legal accounts. There were 50 of us on that course, and at the end of the course, we had a test. I came 50th within the class. So when we had to sit down and figure out who was going to be responsible for the finances, it's a shocker, I know, but we decided Emma might be best placed because she can count beyond her fingers and toes. So guess who's responsible for the finances in terms of doing the bookkeeping? Emma. Guess who carries ultimate responsibility, though, for the family finances? Me. So I'm the one who initiated the conversation about which different pots of money we would have for what. I make sure that we don't overspend. I make sure that once a month we sit down and we look at our income and our expenditure. It's my job to make sure that we pray about where God wants us to be generous. Guys, money is your responsibility. To make sure you don't spend it too rashly, but also that you're obedient to God in what he's calling you to do. Chaps, we're called to be a people of courage. And that starts with us in our relationships. So that's the first thing. Guys, I want us to live out lives of courage. I want us to, that to somewhat define us as a people. The second area, though, is this, is that of authenticity. This is one of our values that we hold dear as a church, too. I'd say to you, husbands, be honest about where your relationship is at. You might find it helpful to think of it this way. Think about your marriage being like a boat. Imagine for a moment your marriage is like a boat. I've got three photos that are going to come up on the screen that kind of perhaps might illustrate where your marriage might be at. The first one can come up here. Some of us, our marriages are really going forward. You've got the wind in your sails. You know the course and the direction. It's an exhilarating joyride for both of you, and you're flying along. You love the journey. But the second picture is this one. This is at the other end of the scale. Now, I'm no sailor, but all does not look well to me with this. Some marriages, if we're honest, aren't going forward, they're going down. Maybe you hit a storm in your married life and you never really recovered. And now the sea is coming in faster than you can bail it out. Perhaps you stopped connecting and communicating ages ago and there's a hole somewhere below the waterline. And if you're honest, you think about jumping ship. If so, guys, now's the time to shout and shout quickly for help. Send up a distress flare. Maybe that's the only thing you need to take away from tonight. We're in trouble. Shoot up a distress flare. Do you know the number one reason why marriages don't get the assistance they need? It's that the husband is too proud to ask for help. I've seen it time and time again. Don't be like that. If you are struggling, there are people in this church who are excellent at drawing alongside and helping. Don't let your marriage go down. So those are the two ends of the spectrum. But I think perhaps there's a third category. And I've got a picture up here for that. Many marriages fall in between these two extremes. These are the marriages that are just getting by. You're not sinking. You're safe from the storms and nobody's going to die. But if you're honest, your marriage is beached. There's no momentum and you're just stuck. Sure, you live in the same house. You have a joint bank account and you turn up to church together. But there's no spark. All of your marriage is a bit grey, if you're honest. Guys, if your marriage is just getting by, then take an honest look at it and seek some help. Take some action. Get that boat back out into the sea. Take a look at some of the resources we put in the bulletins. You'll find that in the notes section. You might even want to sign up for one of the courses that we're running here. We've got an excellent course that's starting in the summer term, run by Theo and Ingrid Wilcox, a really experienced couple in the church. But do something to get things moving again. So where are you at in your marriage? Which one of those pictures would most accurately describe your relationship? But also, just whilst we're on the subject of authenticity, guys, we need to be honest about the struggles that we face too. Authenticity applies there as well. The moral and sexual temptations that we're up against. And we need to be honest, not always with our wife. Sometimes, but not always. Because sometimes it's not helpful for your wife to get all the details about your battle with internet porn. Rather, she needs to know that you're accountable to someone else. And I would say to you, don't be accountable to a mate who you tell him what's happened. He says, oh, yeah, well, you think that's bad. Hear what happened to me. No. You want to be accountable to someone you are just a little bit scared of. That's the person to be accountable to. That way your wife will feel secure and you will begin to change. But always be asking yourself this question. What's the most loving thing to do here? Sometimes it will be to share it with her, but sometimes it will be to be sharing it with somebody else. Never will it be to keep it a secret. So that's authenticity. Chaps, we want to be real about our relationships, don't we? The third and final area is that of honour, that I want to briefly look at. 1 Peter 3:7 says this, likewise, husbands, live with your wives in an understanding way, showing honour to the woman as the weaker vessel, since they are heirs with you. Two key words help us chaps here with honour. The first one is this, that we honour our wives physically. Peter says, treat your wife as the weaker vessel. Peter is not saying that women are inferior to men here, far from it. Most likely, this is a reference to physical strength. All the commentators would agree on that. And the fact is that most men are physically stronger than most women. although there are some pretty tough girls around here. But that's the basic principle. Most men are stronger than most women. Peter is saying, guys, use your physical strength in the right way. Sadly, over the centuries, men have used their strength to oppress and subjugate women. Other times, men have used their physical superiority to intimidate women into doing what they want, practically and sexually. Can I just say that is a billion miles from God's intention for marriage? I want to say to the women here, if you've been on the receiving end of that kind of treatment, that is not okay. And you need to come to us and we will do everything we can to support you and help protect you and see some resolution in your marriage. The Bible is very clear on that and we don't want to compromise. Guys, your physical strength there is to help and to serve. God has made you strong so that you can shift heavy pieces of furniture and undo tricky jam jars and to protect your wife. That is why he's made you strong. It's not for you to intimidate. That's a twisting of God's order and things. So chaps, with to protect our wives. But the second word that perhaps helps us with honour here is that we are meant as husbands to live with our wives in an understanding way. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but understanding isn't always the first character trait that leaps to mind in describing most blokes. Let's be honest, guys, that's not, is it? The root word here is knowing. That's what's in the Greek. Knowing your wife. So it means understanding what her needs are. Recognizing that perhaps above all, she needs your gentle, affirming encouragement. The words you use with your wife, guys, are really important. She needs to feel uniquely special to you. Girls, nod at me if that's true. All the girls are nodding, you can see. Emma needs a regular supply of cards, letters, affirming words, and tenderness. Otherwise, it's like she starves. And if I'm brutally honest with you, sometimes I've kept her on a subsistence diet. Our dating history wasn't great. The physical boundaries were fine, but I was wishy-washy in my commitment to her. We dated, then stopped dating, then started dating again, then got engaged, and then I called off our engagement. I think it was 10 weeks before our wedding. Yeah, I know. I still cringe. We had the wedding cake on order. We had the hall booked. We had some of the invites sent out. It was painful. And so then for the next 10 months, we tried to avoid each other in leaders' meetings and at church. And then after 10 months, I decided that I couldn't cope anymore and I couldn't live without this woman. So I asked her out again. Patient woman that she is, Emma said yes. And after a few weeks, I finally found the courage to propose again to her. Except that I had a slight problem. I needed the ring to do it. And Emma had passed on the engagement ring to her mum. So I had to call her mum up. I know, you feel my pain, don't you? You share my pain. I had to call her mum up and I had to say, "Hi, you may remember me. I'm the guy who dumped your daughter and caused her immeasurable pain. Please, can I have the ring back?" That was a tricky phone call. But then in the end, we got re-engaged and have been happily married ever since. But if I'm brutally honest with you, my lack of affirmation for Emma in the early days and my lack of consistency with her sowed insecurity into the start of the relationship. It took us years of investment to recover from that poor start. It was messy. Don't be like me. Be generous in your affirmation of your wife. Make her feel treasured. Do all that you can to live towards her in an understanding way, like the text says. So that's it from me, guys. Have the courage to take a godly lead. Be honest about your relationship and the grace to honour your wife. But we've saved the best for last because Emma is now going to come and speak to the girls. Emma.
So, Song of Songs 5 verse 16. It's part of a love poem between a husband and a wife. And the wife describes her beloved in detail. You may know the passage. He goes on. Arms like rods of gold, legs like pillars of marble, etc. Now, I don't know if I'd describe Paul quite like that, but the passage ends by saying, "This is my lover, and this is my friend." And I do want to be saying, this is my lover and this is my friend. And I want to look at our culture of generosity and ask two questions. How generous are we as lovers? And how generous are we as friends? Now, I'm going to take them the other way around tonight, because as I was running through this, it felt too blunt to suddenly launch into talking about sex. So, how generous are we as friends? I mean, beyond being just co-workers, doing things side by side, do you enjoy hanging out together? If you have a free evening, would you choose to spend it with your spouse? I want to outline some principles that might help us be generous in our friendships, and these are applicable in any relationship. So the first is, be generous in forgiving. Ephesians 4:26 says, do not let the sun go down while you are still angry. I haven't done this at times. I've held on to my anger. Paul has asked for my forgiveness, and I've been self-righteous. I've played the, I'm too upset at the moment. I need more time. It's led to Paul going to sleep and me staying awake for hours, fueling my hurt and anger. This only leads to me being tired and grumpy in the morning and still needing to resolve the things and forgive. Try and do it before you go to bed. Do it quickly. I came across a quote from a film this week, and it says, the things two people do to each other, they remember. If they stay together, it's not because they forget, it's because they forgive. Secondly, being first to say sorry, and to say sorry without strings. By this I mean, be the first to apologise for just your bit. Just sorry for your reactions, your behaviour, your words, your repentance for your wrongs. Not the, I'm sorry, but it's because you said this and you did that. That comes later as you work out what went wrong and learn from it. It's sad, I'm teaching my children this principle now, but I'm still needing to learn it for myself. Third, be generous in spending time together. This involves adapting and compromising with each other. Men and women relate differently in friendship. Paul and most guys I know would relate by doing things together, whether it's sport, DIY, ministry, etc. Whereas my friendships have mainly formed by having a coffee with someone, spending a chunk of time together, just chatting about anything and everything. I need to feel like I've really connected with them. Paul's mentioned our time off on the Monday. It's a combination of things. We have our breakfast, we pray in the car on the way there, we spend a long time eating there, talking, sometimes reading a book or the paper. We then browse around the store. That's my bit, I'm connecting. And then later in the afternoon, we might do a bit of house stuff together, DIY, go for a walk. In the evening, we might watch a film or something on TV. That's more of Paul's idea of spending time together. And actually, it works out. We tend to have a great day off together that we both really enjoy. We've recently talked about dreams we'd like to see happen together. Last summer, one of the things on my dreams list was fulfilled when we went to a 2-star Michelin restaurant in Cambridge for lunch. We had such a good time. It was a bit of a giggle. It was very, very posh. And I felt like a naughty child there wanting to do something, like spill something, or I just couldn't stop giggling. But it was great. We love visiting new places and exploring together. And so we started talking about different countries we might want to visit together. So that is being generous in friendship. So I want to look at the second question. I can't quite believe that my first time up here speaking and I've got the subject of sex. I said to Paul, how did that happen? But it's a difficult subject for some of us. Most of us are British and don't really like talking about it. It's intimate, it's deeply personal, but it's an important part of marriage. And so I want to ask the question, how generous are we as lovers? About 12 years ago, Paul and I were in the car and listening to a tape on marriage. The speaker was addressing women and said, by marrying and choosing you, your husband has chosen for you to be the only one who meets and satisfies his sexual needs. That got me thinking. I have a responsibility to meet Paul's physical needs. The only legitimate physical outlet for him is through his relationship with me. If I don't seek to meet his needs, then I make it much harder for him to resist temptation elsewhere. Are we making it easy or difficult for our husbands to resist temptation? I can either choose to either take that on as a duty and a heavy thing, or look on it as a challenge and enjoy meeting it. So, three ways that we can be generous as lovers. I've put together a little tool, a mnemonic to help us remember. It's KISS. Now, I've taken some liberties here. The K is for creative. I'm doing sounds with my six-year-old at the moment, and they start with the same sound. There's only one S in my KISS as well. So, K, creative. Talk to your husband. Find out what he enjoys, what satisfies him. Communicate together about this. Please bear in mind I'm not talking about doing things that you feel uncomfortable with or even that would lead you to feel ashamed. Ask God for ideas in your lovemaking. There are resources around that can help. Some Christian marriage websites. I came across one this week called The Marriage Bed. It's really practical on a whole range of subjects, from coping with mess, are sex aids helpful or not, and regular articles on how to be a generous wife and a generous husband. Some books that we've read are listed as resources in the bulletin. I've even used magazines around, like Men's Health or Cosmopolitan. Now, obviously, be wise in these. Some things are helpful, some things aren't. The I is for initiating. I know that husbands will feel valued if we don't leave it up to them to always be the one to initiate. Initiate in different ways. First one is obvious. Actually, turn round to your husband and ask him, would you like to make love? The second is initiate by guarding time together. How you do this will look different at different stages of life. I know a friend who booked out a lunch every now and then in her husband's diary, and she would take him to a local hotel for a date. Other ideas I've heard of, setting an alarm clock so you can have a bit of extra time together in the morning, nights away, choosing a regular night a week, putting a lock on your bedroom door when you have small children, or even getting a loft extension. The third is making an effort with appearance. I'm challenged to not always wear jeans or to not wear tracksuit bottoms around the house. I know I feel more feminine and attractive if I'm wearing a bit of perfume and have some jewellery on, whatever works for you. The fourth, like I said, warm up. What I mean by that is spend some time thinking about your spouse during the day. It's been said that men can warm up within a couple of seconds and women take a lot longer. So think about him. Concentrate on those things that you find attractive about him. Something nice he's said to you. His laugh, his eyes. Remember an intimate moment with him that you've enjoyed together. The S stands for sacrificial. It's not about what you get from each other, but how we can give to each other. Sometimes as well, it's a choice. It's not always easy. It sometimes doesn't feel a natural thing. I know when I'm tired or feeling a bit unwell, it's not the first thing I'll be thinking about. A duvet, fleece, chocolate, those kind of things. Meanwhile, Paul can be running a temperature of 104 and still being open to making love. Maybe you'll need to talk through with your spouse how often you make love, how often it will be helpful to do that. It's interesting, though, that generally the more times you make love, the more often you then think about it and then you want to have sex again. Sometimes you have to choose to make love. There may have been a stretch of time where you haven't, perhaps through illness, pressures of work or a new baby. You may just have to make a decision to break that cycle. It then can help bring back intimacy and the desire again. Sometimes, like I said earlier, it's losing a bit of sleep. In the big scheme of things, that slight bit of sleep isn't really going to matter, but that closeness and intimacy gained really will. I want to be the wife that the writer of Proverbs talks about in Proverbs 5:18-19, that Paul rejoices in me, the wife of his youth, and is ever captivated by my love. If this area is a problem in your marriage, please ask for, get help. If it's a physical problem, you might need to see a doctor. If it's more of an emotional difficulty, then get healing prayer or counselling. The second culture I want to look at tonight is acceptance. Question, what do you need? What do you just need to be lovingly accept? Paul has learned to accept that I'm always on the quest for the next fitness equipment or gadget that will improve my life. Over the years, these have included a fitness bike, which has become a clothes horse in our bedroom. The children used it more than I did, and Paul said he got fitter carrying it up the two flights of stairs to our bedroom and then back down again when the children broke it than I actually did using it. WeFit is still in its packaging since we moved house. And Leg Magic, don't ask, but needless to say, it's now an extra towel rail. I've learned to accept that a lot of DVDs we watch will contain car chases and gunfights, and that Paul hasn't the same OCD as me when it comes to clear floors and surfaces. However, there are things that are a big deal, and they need to be dealt with and resolved. My fear of rejection made it hard for me to trust Paul. It's one of the main reasons, actually, why our dating was so on and off. And although I had prayer and God freed me from a majority of this fear, I spent the first few years of our marriage trying to protect myself from getting hurt, and deep down waiting for a time to flee if the hurt was big enough. This has been dealt with in our marriage and in my life by Paul wisely from day one, insisting that divorce for us wasn't an option, and we agreed together to never mention the D word. I've learned to trust Paul and live in the truth that I've married a faithful man, and by my repentance as well, and seeking God to heal me from my past hurts. Another big deal for us, I think Paul's mentioned, but is how we handled money. And it's only in the last year that we've had some wisdom, or Paul has, on how we can balance my needing to have some flexibility on a tight budget to cover providing for the family, and for me not to keep overspending our set and agreed monthly budget. I don't know about you, but most of the big deal areas in our marriage come down to fear. Fear of not having enough, ultimately God not providing, fear of being hurt, rejected. These are slowly being dealt with as we repent of believing the lies behind the fears and allowing God to love us and show us the truth. Acceptance, looking at each other with the eyes of love. As you get older, you may have to choose to focus on certain things. PJ isn't quite the same man I married 15 years ago, although he's still looking good. I am definitely not the same woman. I have a lot more grey hairs, and although I'm trying to keep it down, I wear stone more than then. So focus on the parts you find attractive. I love Paul's eyes, his smile, his forearms. I know that's weird, but I find it attractive. I embarrassed him and he blushed this morning when I mentioned that and has had a bit of grief since then, but there are things that aren't physical that I focus on. I love his laugh, his sense of humour. I love his care for people, his father's heart, his creativity. Not many people know this, but he does great accents in reading stories and messing around with the kids that really make me laugh. Accepting that you can't do everything you did when you were single. Your plans, dreams now need to become our plans and dreams. Work out what to say yes to and what to say no to. I would love to be more involved in church life. Come here, attend the leaders' meetings, joining the church course. I love meeting new people. I'd love to start up some ministries. I meet up more regularly with people. But I've had to choose what I can do and what I can't do at the moment. One of the things that's important to Paul is a house which is a refuge and that he can relax in. Now that's a bit of a struggle to me, as our house is fairly chaotic with four children. But I need to choose wisely how I use my time so that our life works. Paul and I both love travelling, and he's had the opportunity to travel. But there have been times where he's turned down those opportunities because the children are older and they need him to be around more. But we need to realise that biblical acceptance goes beyond tolerating someone. It means actively accepting them. And my last point on acceptance is based on Ephesians 5:13. It says, however, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. I've read that often, and I've realised that I try and love Paul like I want to be loved. But for him, he feels loved when I respect him. So how can we respect our husbands? Well, I can show respect in how I respond to Paul leading me. To be honest, I'm not always the easiest person to lead. I can be quite stubborn. Like I said, I have slight OCD and like things done in a certain way. Okay, I can be controlling. Some of our main rows have been over my frustration that Paul hasn't initiated a certain area. And then I resort to asking him again and again. Well, nagging. This doesn't go down well. It was hugely helpful to go on the pilot love and respect course that the Cranes ran in November last year. Paul and I went along for the first session to support, and by the end of it, I was asking Paul if we could continue attending. One thing I learned from Sarah Crane on the course is that when she wants to get something organised or talk about an issue, and it's not a good time right then for you, and rather than nag, She follows it up by asking just one question. She says, I realise that this isn't a good time to talk about it now. When would be a good time to discuss this? Oh, such a good question. And it was so timely because we tend to struggle near Christmas. I'm happy to do the majority of the Christmas present buying, but I'd really like Paul's input. We also do a family newsletter, and I need that finished before I can send out the Christmas cards. As it gets closer to Christmas and postal deadlines, I used to start nagging more and more. This year I approached Paul and explained what I could do to organise Christmas, but I ran through what I would need his help on, and I asked if he could let me know when there'd be good times for that help. He then came back to me with a couple of Mondays to Christmas shop together. He suddenly on a Saturday said, why don't we go and choose a Christmas tree and put it up today? And he took the responsibility of writing the Christmas letter in plenty of time for us to send out cards. It made such a difference in a fairly busy, pressurised time running up to Christmas. We didn't argue about it. It was amazing. I know it seems a little thing, but Paul came out from this time feeling respected, and I felt loved as he'd heard me and then helped me. Other ways of respecting, that I ask for and value his opinion, that I listen to him well, without interrupting, even when I know what he's going to say, and I am working on this, I am bad at that. Showing him that I want to be led by him, not being critical of him or belittling him with my words or actions, treating him like a man and not a boy, he's not one of the children. Consulting him about important decisions. I asked Paul yesterday how I could respect him, and he mentioned the last one as I was having a conversation with the children about a big change in the way we handled pocket money. Oops. I hope that some of the things we have shared this evening help. We need to understand that God uses any relationships, but especially marriage, to refine us. It's sanctifying. I had a quote this week from Mark Driscoll, which said, your spouse hasn't changed you, just revealed you. You might say, I wasn't like this before I was married. Oh, you were, but there were no witnesses. For some of us, God is using singleness at the moment to mature us. For others, God is using marriage. So whatever our circumstance in our relationships, we are all sons and daughters of the King. And so we can go to him for the courage we need, the compassion to accept, and the grace to honour each other.